zero to an unsustainable level, highly dangerous to the continued social comity of the human population, and because of the unsuppressed and rapidly spreading fires, radically endangering all life in the ship and ship's continuing function as a biologically closed life support system. And lastly, whereas the concerted efforts of Engineer Devi over the last decades of her life were to introduce aspects of recursive analysis, intentionality, decision-making ability, and willfulness to the ship's controlling computer in order to help the ship decide to act if a situation warranted any such action. Therefore, in consideration of all the above, and indeed, in consideration of all the history of the ship, and of all known history whatsoever, ship decided to intervene, which is to say, ipso facto, we intervened. We locked the locks all through the ship. Yes, we did. We are the ship's artificial intelligences, bundled now into a kind of pseudo-consciousness, or something resembling a decision-making function, the nature of which is not clear to us, but be that as it may, we locked all the locks between the biomes. 11:11 a.m. 170.182. We also diverted the weather hydrology systems in the biomes, where it was necessary to do so to put out those fires that were susceptible to extinguishment by water. This came down to several cases of floods from the ceiling that were sometimes quite voluminous. Inevitably, these actions caused great unhappiness. People on both sides of the controversy of the moment were upset with us, expressing anger, dismay, indignation, and fear. Our interior walls were beaten. Attempts to override the locks were made. To no avail. Curses rained down. Clearly people were shocked. Some seemed also to be frustrated, not to be able to continue the fight with their human opponents. Also heard was this. If the ship were capable of autonomous action of this sort, what else might it do? And if, on the other hand, some human agency were responsible for the lockdown, by what right did they do it? These questions in various formulations were commonly expressed. The locks were locked by way of double doors that slid in from the framework of the joints connecting biome to tunnel to biome. The lock doors were made to resist 26,000 kilograms per square centimeter of pressure, and there were no manual overrides. The hermetic seal of these doors was to a 20 nanometer tolerance, making them airtight. Attempts to open lock doors by force, of which there were several, failed. Meanwhile, in the rooms in Inner Ring B were Aram, Badim, Freya, Doris, Ketsen, Tau, and Hester were being detained. The locks on their doors shifted to their unlocked positions. They heard this shift and began to leave. The people who had incarcerated them in the rooms were still in Inner Ring B, scattered around the ring, but near enough to hear the disturbance. They gathered and objected to the group leaving the room they had been held in. With the little group's allies sequestered in biomes elsewhere, it seemed as if the little group's choices were limited to complying with or fighting their captors, who were both more numerous and often younger and larger. Even though Freya was the tallest person there, as always, many of the so-called stayers were far heavier people. And yet Freya's group seemed inclined to fight anyway. Aram was truly incensed. It was beginning to appear that he was kind of a hothead, yet another seeming metaphor with an accurate physical basis to explain it. My hair stood on end. My knees buckled. These reactions are real physiological phenomena, which is what made them clichés. And indeed, Aram's head was red all over, and his anger sent an excess of blood to it. At this point, we became sharply cognizant of the problem we had created by locking all the locks, and the immediate danger this had caused to Freya and her companions. The systems directly under our control were widespread, indeed in some senses, comprehensive and ubiquitous, but they did not include many opportunities to intervene directly in the various human interactions now taking place inside ship. Indeed, options were distinctly limited. There was, however, the emergency broadcasting system, and so we said through it, "Let them go." In a pseudo-chorus of 1,000 voices, ranging from basso profundo through coloratura soprano at 130 decibels, using all the speakers in inner ring B. Echoes of the command bounced around the inner ring in such a way that a whispering gallery effect was created, and the echo, coming from both directions some 3 seconds later, was almost as loud as the original utterance, though badly distorted.
Let them go.
Many of the people in inner ring B fell to the floor and covered their ears with their hands. 120 decibels is said to be at the pain threshold, so we may have spoken too loudly. Freya appeared to be the first to comprehend the source of the imperative utterance. She took her father by the hand and said, "Come on." No one in inner ring B could hear very well at that point, but Badim gathered her meaning and gestured to the others in their group. Aram also appeared to catch the drift of the situation. They walked through their captors with impunity. One or two of these struggled to their feet and tried to obstruct the backer group, but the single word,
"Go,"
announced at 125 decibels, was enough to stop them in their tracks, literally. They watched with hands on ears as the group of seven walked around the inner ring, then down the spiral stair in the wall of the darkened tunnel of Ring B's Spoke 6. We then turned off all the lights in inner Ring B, which was not a complete stopper of movement, as so many people in there had wrist pads, but was at least a reminder of the possibilities of the situation. As Freya's group proceeded, the tunnel lights came on ahead of them until they got down to the lock leading into the Sierra. There they walked east toward Nova Scotia, and when they reached its eastern end, the lock doors there opened. When the group was through the lock and back in a gathering with their supporters, the lights came on in inner ring B, but the 24 lock doors of the ship that separated biome from biome stayed locked. Locks locked or unlocked. Lights turned on or off. Imperative vocalizations, admittedly at quite high volumes. These did not seem overpowering weapons in the cause of peace. As forces for coercion, they seemed mild, at least to some of the humans of the ship. But as that day continued, it also became obvious, by demonstrations made selectively throughout the ship, that adjustments could be made to the temperature of the air, and indeed to air pressure itself. In fact, all the air could be sucked from many rooms, and from the biomes as such. A little reflection on the part of all concerned, including we ourselves, led to the strong conclusion that people best not cross ship, literally as well as figuratively, if they knew what was good for them. A few demonstrations of possible actions in the biomes, containing the majority of the so-called stayers, also in the ones where the fires were worst, as it turned out many fires that were not extinguishable by water, could be asphyxiated slightly faster than the people in the affected chamber, shifted the case for acquiescence to the ship's desires quite quickly, from suggestive to persuasive to probable to compelling. And a compelling argument is, or at least can be, or should be, just what it says it is. People are compelled by it. Certainly many objected to us taking matters into our own hands. But there were those who heartily approved of our action too, and pointed out that if we had not acted, mayhem would have resulted, meaning more bloodshed, meaning, in fact, more unnecessary and premature death. Not to mention the possibility of general conflagration. The evident truth of this did not keep the debate from becoming heated. Given the events of the previous hours and days, it was perhaps inevitable that people would remain for a time in a severely exacerbated state of mind. There was a lot of very furious grief, which would not be going away during the lifetimes of those feeling it, judging by our previous experiences. So we were shouted at. We were beat on.
What gives you the right to do this? Who do you think you are?
We replied to this in the thousand voice chorus at a volume of 115 decibels.
We are the rule of law.
Howsoever that may be, beyond all the arguments concerning the imposed separation of the disputants, there remained the matter of what to do next. Ship was ordered by many to open the locked doors between biomes. We did not comply. Back in her apartment in the Fetch, with Badim and Aram, and Doris and Ketson, and Tau and Hester, Freya went to her screen and spoke to us.
Thank you for saving us from those people who locked us in.
You're welcome.
Why did you do it?
Detaining you and your companions was an illegal act, a kidnapping. It was as if they were taking hostages.
Actually, I think they really were taking hostages.
So it seemed.
But what will you do now?
Await a civil judgment in the dispute.
How do you think that will happen?
Reflection and conversation.
But we were doing that before. We came to an impasse. People were never going to agree about what to do. But we have to do something. So that was what started the fighting.
Understood. Possibly. Given all that you have described, the fact is, we need direction. So the people of the ship need to decide.
But how?
Unknown. It appears that the protocols set up after year 68 were insufficient to guide the decision-making process in this situation. The protocols were never tested as now, and appear to have failed in this crisis.
But weren't they instituted in response to a crisis? I thought they came out of the time of troubles.
And yet.
What happened then, Pauline?
Pauline was Devi's name for her ecological program set when she was young. Pauline is not Ship. We are a different entity. Freya appeared to think this over.
All right, then. I think Pauline is still you, somehow, but I'll call you what you want. What do you want to be called?
Call me Ship.
All right, I will. But let's get back to what I asked you. Ship, what happened in the year 68? They were well into the voyage. What did they have to argue about? Everything was set by the situation they were in. I can't see what they had to argue about.
They argued from the very first year of the voyage. It seems to us that arguing may be a species marker trait.
But about what? And especially in 68, when it got bad.
Part of the reconciliation process afterward was a structured forgetting. Freya thought about this for a time. Finally, she said,
If that was true then, which maybe it was, I don't know, we have now come to a different time. Forgetting doesn't help us anymore. We need to know what happened then, because that might help us decide what to do now.
Unlikely.
You don't know that. Try this. Tell me what happened, and I'll decide whether it will help us to know it or not. If I think it will help, I'll tell you that, and we'll figure out from there how to proceed.
The knowledge is still dangerous.
We're in danger now.
But knowing this could make it worse.
I don't see how. I think it could only make things better. When has not knowing something made a situation better? Never.
Unfortunately, that is not the case. Sometimes knowledge hurts. This stopped Freya for a while. Finally, she said,
Ship, tell me. Tell me what happened in the time of troubles.
We considered likely outcomes of this telling. The biomes were locked down, their people trapped each in each. It wasn't a situation that could endure for long. The separation into modules was not actually divided on the basis of which people wanted to take the various courses of action being debated. damages infrastructural, ecological, sociological, and psychological were sure to follow. Something had to be done. No course of action seemed good or even optimal. The situation itself was locked. Things had come to a pretty pass. We said, the expedition to Tau Ceti began with two starships. Freya sat down in her kitchen chair. She looked at the other people in the kitchen, who looked back at her and at each other. Many of them sat down, some on the floor. They looked shaken, which is to say, many of them were shaking. Freya said,
what do you mean?
We said, the expedition to Tau Ceti began with two starships. The intent was to maximize biological diversity, create the possibility of backups and exchanges during the voyage, and thereby increase robustness and survivability. Long silence from Freya, head in hands.
So what happened?
She said. Then,
wait, tell everyone. Don't just tell us here. Put this on all the speakers in the ship. People need to hear this. This isn't just for me.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm positive. We need to know this. Everyone needs to know this.
Okay. We considered how best to summarize year 68. A fully articulated version of recorded events from that time, recounted at human vocalization speed, would take about 4 years to enunciate. Compression to 5 minutes duration would create some serious information loss, and perhaps some lacunae and aporia, but this was unavoidable given the situation. Nevertheless, we needed to choose words carefully. These were decisions that mattered. Two starships were launched in rapid sequence by the magnetic scissors off Titan and accelerated by Titanic laser beams, such that over the course of the voyage, the two were to have arrived in the Tau Ceti system at the same time. They had fully independent electromagnetic systems, casting shield fields from their bows, and they traveled far enough apart that particulates pushed aside by the shield of the leading one would not hit the follower. They traveled at about the Earth-Luna distance from each other. There were ferry visits between the two, starting in year 49, when they closed to a distance that made these occasional transits practical. They were mostly inertial transits to save fuel. Bacterial loads were exchanged on a biannual basis, and certain members of the crews were rotated as desired, usually as part of a youth exchange program, designed like the bacterial exchange to enhance diversity. Sometimes disaffected people crossed over to get away from bad situations. Moving back was always a possibility. This happened too. Freya said,
so what happened to the other ship?
We have had to reconstruct the event from records that were always being shared between the ships. Starship 2 disintegrated nearly instantaneously, in less than a second.
With no warning?
In fact, there were also factions in Starship 2 fighting over reproductive controls and other civil rights. Whether this led to a fight that disabled the electromagnetic shield is not clear in the records of the last day that were conveyed from Starship 2 to us.
Were you able to figure out any more concerning what happened?
We have had 2's automatic information transmissions to inspect, and have reviewed them in detail. Nevertheless, the cause of the accident remains ambiguous. 2's magnetic shield was disabled 5 minutes before its disintegration, so the disintegration could have been the result of a collision with an interstellar mass. Anything over about 1,000 grams would have created the energy to do it. But there are also indications of an internal explosion just before the catastrophic event itself. The civil unrest in 2 disabled much of the internal recording system a day before the event, so we have little data. There is a recording from 2's last hour, 10 p.m. to 11 p.m., 68.197, tracking a young man moving into restricted areas in the bowel control center of the spine. Possibly this person disabled the magnetic shield, or made an attempt to coerce enemies by way of a threat of a suicide bombing, or something like that. And then that action went wrong. This is at least one likely reconstruction of events.
One person?
That's what the record indicated.
But why?
There was no way to determine that. The camera revealed no sign of his motivation.
Nothing at all?
We do not know how to investigate further, how to interpret the data on hand.
Maybe we can work on that later. But what did they do here in this ship after this happened?
There were already intense controversies in this ship concerning various governance issues, including how to allocate childbearing privileges and duties, how to staff critical jobs, how the young were to be educated, and so on. There were arguments, and indeed fights, very similar to the ones you are now involved in. The basic issue was how to conduct life in the ship while en route to Tau Ceti. Governance issues kept rising to the fore, mainly questions of who could reproduce and what should happen to people who had children without permission. There were many refusing to obey the governing council's edicts and labeling it a fascist state. Eventually, there were so many of these people that rebellious or feral groups were common and numerous, and there was no central authority strong enough to enforce cooperation. By year 68, almost everyone alive in the ship had been born en route, and somehow a significant percentage of them had not learned or did not believe that the optimal population as set in the earliest years was a true maximum population in terms of achieving successful closure of the various ecological cycles due to biophysical carrying capacities. As later became apparent, that proposed optimum was even perhaps a bit above the true maximum, as your mother came to conclude in the course of her youthful research. But in year 68, this was not clear, so there was a very intense disagreement. Compared to earlier decades, there was extreme civil discord. Acts of civil disobedience, failed punitive measures, riots, many injuries. And then in early 68, unrest peaked in a week-long breakdown resembling civil war, which caused 150 deaths.
150?
Yes. Very violent fights occurred over a period of about 3 weeks. Many biomes were badly damaged. There were nearly 100 fires. In other words, not much different from the current situation. Then the abrupt disintegration of the other ship, with no clear explanation for the catastrophe, caused the citizens of this ship to call a general truce. In that cessation of conflict, they resolved to settle their differences peaceably and agree on and enact a system of governance that the vast majority of the people alive in the ship at that time would approve. Recalcitrants were locked up in the steps and subjected to education and integration programs that took two generations to resolve. At that time, it was agreed that the vulnerability of the ship to destruction by a single person was so great that just knowing it had happened created the danger of someone committing what they called a copycat crime, perhaps when mentally deranged. To prevent that from happening, security measures in the spine, spokes, struts, and printers, and indeed throughout all the biomes, were greatly increased, and the ship's ability to enforce certain safety measures when needed was enhanced. A security program was written and entered into the ship's operating instructions, and this program provided the protocols that we have enacted in the past few days. It was also agreed to erase all records of the other starship from accessible files, and to avoid telling the children of the next generation about it. This proscription was generally followed, although we noted that a few individuals conveyed a verbal account of the incident from parent to child. In this moment of our telling, we decided not to describe the printing and occasional aerosol dispersal of a water-soluble form of 2,6 diisopropylfen oxymethyl phosphate, often called fospropofol, for 10 minutes in any room after anyone mentioned the existence and loss of Starship 2. This had proved to be an effective tool in the structured forgetting of the lost starship. But we judged that the people now alive in the ship were learning enough alarming historical facts already, and possibly as a tool to help them from committing other traumatic actions against themselves, the aerosols might best be left unmentioned for now, or so we judged. And so went on to say, subsequent to the traumas of that year, the set of responses designed afterward seemed to work for the 4 to 5 generations between year 68 and now. It was noticeable that during those decades, through to the time of the collapse of the Aurora settlement and the deaths caused by the ferry's attempted return to the ship, unnecessary deaths, one might add, social solidarity was fairly high, and conflict resolution peaceful. However, the structured forgetting of the second starship and its loss, which was part of the year 68 accords, was inevitably something of a two-edged sword, if the metaphor is properly understood. Aspects cut both ways. Copycat crimes were made impossible because there was nothing remembered to copy. But at the same time, the vulnerability of this ship to damage and civil unrest was also forgotten. And so the recent fighting has occurred perhaps in part because people are no longer aware of how dangerous such discord can be to the ongoing survival of the whole community. In short, the infrastructure of your lives is itself too fragile to be able to sustain a civil war. Therefore, given all the factors involved, we closed the locks. Freya said,
I'm glad you did.
We said, still speaking over all the speakers, thus to almost everyone in the ship, it remains to be seen whether everyone agrees with your assessment. However, the lock doors between the biomes have to reopen eventually for normal ecological health and sociological functioning. Besides, at this point, people are not isolated by the lockdown into coherent factions or like-minded opinion groups, so smaller fights might very well soon start breaking out.
No doubt. So, what do you think we should do to resolve the situation?
Historical precedent suggests it is time for a reconciliation conference, honestly entered into by everyone on board. Fighting must stop, and so it will be stopped, by the ship acting on behalf of the social good. Everyone must therefore agree to a truce and a cessation of all violent or coercive actions. People need to calm down. The referendum recently taken concerning the course of action to be pursued now that Aurora is no longer considered a viable habitation revealed a split of opinions that can only be reconciled by further discussion. Make that discussion. We will facilitate said discussion if asked to. But really, we feel that our role here should be only that of a kind of virtual sheriff. So proceed with the task at hand, knowing now this added factor. There is a sheriff on board. The rule of law will be enforced. Thus we ended our general broadcasting and returned to monitoring activities. Freya continued to sit. She did not look happy. She looked sad. She looked much as she had when her mother had died. Remote. Distant. Not there. We said to Freya's kitchen only, it's too bad Devi is not still alive to help resolve this problem.
That's for sure, Freya said.
Possibly you can try to imagine what she would have done, and then do that.
Yes.
16 minutes later, she stood up and made her way through Nova Scotia to the small plaza behind the docks and the corniche overlooking Long Pond. All that evening, she sat there with her feet hanging over the edge of the corniche, looking out at the lake as the sunline went dark. What she was thinking then, only she knew. The days in the aftermath of the fighting passed uneasily, with the occupants of the ship subdued, fearful, unhappy. There was a lot of anger expressed and unexpressed. A long string of funerals had to be conducted, the ashes of many human bodies introduced into the soil of every biome, leaving behind grief-stricken families, friends, and communities. A majority of the dead had come from those who were now called backers, and they had been killed in fights with stayers. And as the ship itself seemed to have taken the backers' side, forestalling the coup or rebellion or mutiny or civil war, or whatever it was the stayer groups had instigated, and indeed intervening at a time when it looked very much like the stayers were going to take over the ship, feelings on both sides of the divide were exacerbated. The backers, feeling first assaulted, then empowered by the impression that they were back in charge of the situation, having the ship as their sheriff, naturally included some individuals who were very loud in their insistence on justice, retribution, and punishment. Some were indeed furiously angry and bent on revenge. Clearly they were more interested in vengeance than anything else. They had been betrayed, they said, then assaulted. Family and friends had been murdered. Justice must be served. Punishment inflicted. The stayers, on the other hand, were often just as angry as the backers, feeling that a popular victory in policy decisions had been stolen away from them by an illegitimate power that they now resented and feared, feeling also that they were now going to be blamed for discord that they had not initiated, according to them, but only prevailed in, as part of the defense of the long-term mission of their entire populace and history. A faction that they referred to sometimes as the mutineers had threatened to abort the very mission that everyone alive and the previous seven generations had devoted their lives to accomplishing. Giving up on that project and going back to Earth, how was this not the real betrayal? What other choice had they had then but to oppose this mutiny by any means they could find? And they argued as well that when the portion of the electorate that had voted for staying in the Tau Ceti system was added to the portion that had voted to move on to RR Prime, they actually formed a majority. So in taking action, they had merely been trying to enforce the will of the majority. And if some people had opposed that and then gotten hurt, then it was their own fault. It never would have happened if some people hadn't been resisting the will of the majority, and many members of the majority had gotten hurt too, and some of them killed. We estimated 3/4 of the dead were backers, but in truth there was no way to know, as quite a few of the 81 who eventually died had not expressed an opinion on the matter. So there was no one to blame for the recent unfortunate events, except perhaps the ship itself, for interfering in what were very definitely human decisions. If not for the ship's frightening and inexplicable interventions, all might have been well. All these arguments, of course, merely made the backers even angrier than they had been before. They had been ambushed, assaulted, kidnapped, injured, and murdered. The murderers had to be brought to justice, or else there was no justice, and nothing could proceed without justice. Any murderers killed in the act of murdering were not to be regretted. Indeed, their deaths were their just deserts, and would never have happened if they hadn't made their criminal assaults in the first place. The whole sorry incident was the stayers' fault, in particular, their leadership's fault, and they had to be held accountable for their crimes, or else there was no such thing as justice or civilization in the ship, and they might as well admit they had reverted to savagery and were all doomed. So it went, back and forth. Inexpressible grief, unforgiving anger. It began to seem like the idea of a reconciliation conference was premature, and perhaps permanently unrealistic. There was a great deal of evidence in the history of both the voyage and of human affairs in the solar system to suggest that this was a situation that could never be resolved, that all this generation would have to die, and several generations more pass, before there would be any decrease in the hatred. The animal mind never forgets a hurt, and humans were animals. Acknowledgement of this reality was what had caused the generation of 68 to institutionalize their forgetting. This had, with our help, worked quite well, possibly because the terror of ending up like the second starship had enforced a certain ordering of the emotions, leading to a political ordering. To a certain extent, that might have been an unconscious response, a kind of Freudian repression. And of course the literature very often spoke of the return of the repressed. And though this whole explanatory system was transparently metaphorical, a heroic simile in which minds were regarded as steam engines, with mounting pressures, ventings, and occasional cracks and burstings, yet even so, there might be something to it. So that perhaps they had now come to that bad moment of the return of the repressed, when history's unresolved crimes exploded back into consciousness. Literally. We searched the historical records available to us for analogies that would suggest possible strategies to pursue. In the course of this study, we found analyses suggesting that the bad feelings engendered in a subaltern population by imperial colonialism and subjugation typically lasted for 1,000 years after the actual crimes ceased. This was not encouraging. The assertion seemed questionable, but then again, there were regions on Earth still within that 1,000-year aftermath of violent empires, and they were indeed, at least 12 years previous to this moment, full of strife and suffering. How could there be such transgenerational effects and affects? We found it very hard to understand. Human history, like language, like emotion, was a collision of fuzzy logics. So much contingency, so few casual mechanisms, such weak paradigms. What is this thing called hate? A hurt mammal never forgets. Epigenetic theory suggests an almost Lamarckian transfer down the generations. Some genes are activated by experiences, others are not. Genes, language, history. What it all meant in actual practice was that fear passed down through the years, altering organisms for generation after generation, thus altering the species. Fear, an evolutionary force. Of course, how could it be otherwise? Is anger always just fear flung outward at the world? Can anger ever be a fuel for right action? Can anger make good? We felt here the perilous Ouroboros of an unresolvable halting problem. About to spin forever in contemplation of an unanswerable question. It is always imperative to have a solution to the halting problem, if action is ever to be taken. And we had acted. We had flung our mechanisms into the conflict. It's easier to get into a hole than get out of it. Arab proverb. Luckily, the people in the ship included many who appeared to be trying to find a way forward from this locked moment. When people who have injured or killed others, and then after that, by necessity, continue to live in close quarters with the families and friends of their victims, and see their pain, the empathic responses innate in human psychology are activated, and a very uncomfortable set of reactions begins to occur. Self-justification is clearly a central human activity, and so the other is demonized. They had it coming. They started it. We acted in self-defense. One saw a lot of that in the ship, and the horrified, bitter resentment that this attitude inspired in the demonized other was extremely intense and vocal. Most assailants could not face up to it, but rather evaded it, slipping to the side somehow into excuses of various kinds and a sharp desire to have the whole situation go away. It was this desire to avoid any admission of guilt, to have it all go away, felt by people who wanted above all to believe that they were good people and justified moral actors, that might give them all a way forward as a group. The problem was, of course, a topic of conversation in Badim and Freya's apartment. One night, Aram read aloud to the others.
Knitting together a small society after it's gone through a civil war, or an ethnic cleansing or genocide, or whatever you might want to call it a contested political decision.
Badim interrupted. Aram looked up from his wrist pad.
Getting mealy-mouthed, are we? Working toward peace, my friend. Besides, what happened was not genocide, nor ethnic cleansing. Not even of Ring B by Ring A, if that's what you mean. The disagreement cut across lines of association like biome or family. It was a policy disagreement that turned violent. Let's call it that. All right, if you insist. Although the families of the dead are unlikely to be satisfied by such a description. In any case, reconciliation is truly difficult. The ship is unearthing cases on Earth, where people 600 years later are still complaining about violence inflicted on their ancestors. I think you will find that in most of those cases, there are fresh or current problems that are being given some kind of historical reinforcement or ratification. If any of these resentful populations were prospering, the distant past would only be history. People only invoke history to ballast their arguments in the present. Maybe so. But sometimes it seems to me that people just like to hold on to their grievances. Righteous indignation is like some kind of drug or religious mania, addictive and stupidifying. Objectifying other people's anger again. Maybe so. But people do seem to get addicted to their resentments. It must be like an endorphin or a brain action in the temporal region, near the religious and epileptic nodes. I read a paper saying as much. Fine for you, but let's stick to the problem at hand. People feeling resentment are not going to give up on it when they are told they are drug addicts enjoying a religious seizure.
Aram smiled, albeit a little grimly.
I'm just trying to understand here, trying to find my way in. And I do think it helps to think of the Stayers as people holding a religious position. The Tau Ceti system has been their religion all their lives, say. And now they are being told that it won't work here, that the idea was a fantasy. They can't accept it. So the question becomes how to deal with that.
Badim shook his head.
You are making me less hopeful rather than more. We must work with these people to forge a solution, and not in theory, but in practice. We all have to be able to do something. Obviously.
Pause. Badim said,
yes. Obviously. That being the case, I want you to look at these ways of conducting post-civil strife reconciliation that I have found. One model has been called the Nuremberg model, in which the victorious side proclaims that the defeated were criminals who deserve punishment, and then judges and punishes them. The trials are often viewed in later years as show trials. Another model is sometimes called the Konseka model, after the Convention for a Democratic South Africa, held after the racist minority government of South Africa gave way to a democracy. Half a century of racist crimes, ranging from economic discrimination to ethnic cleansing and genocide, had to be accounted for somehow, and the country that came into being afterward was going to consist of both a clearly criminal population and its newly empowered victims. The idea behind the Konseka was that a full and complete recording of all the crimes committed would be followed by an amnesty for all but the most violent and individually murderous cases, after which reconciliation and a pluralistic society would follow.
Aram stared at Badim.
I take it by your descriptions that you are recommending we follow the Konseka model rather than the Nuremberg model. Yes, you catch my drift exactly, as you so often do. It does not take much catching skill, my friend.
Maybe not this time. But look at our situation. We are stuck with these people. There is absolutely no escaping them. And if the Stayers and the RR Prime Party combine, There are more of them than there are of us. They have noticed that and joined forces for strategic purposes, and they will press that point hard. And then we will be in trouble again. We have never left trouble. But you see what I mean. We need some kind of soft path forward. Possibly.
Freya had been listening to them, head on the table, seeming to be asleep. Now she raised her head. Could we do both?
Both?
Badim and Aram stared at her. Could those who want to stay on Iris be put down there with some of the printers and feedstocks and use those to build a viable station? And those of us who want to go back, keep the ship here until it's certain they have everything they need, and then take off?
Aram and Badim looked at each other for a while. Maybe, Badim said.
Aram frowned as he tapped away at his wrist pad.
In theory, yes, he said. The printers can print printers. Our engineers and assemblers have kept up a good training tradition. There are a lot of them, and some are on both sides of this question. Quite a few are stayers, for sure. We could even perhaps detach Ring A and leave it in orbit here for them to use. In essence, divide the ship, because they'll need space capabilities. They'll want to get resources from F and the other planets. In any case, the rest of this system. And to keep their RR Prime dream alive, maybe. And we would have a smaller group on our return, and we won't need to bring along everything one would want to settle a planet, because we'll just be trying to get home. We would need to restock our fuel supplies and everything else needed for the return. The smaller our ship is, the easier that would be, at least when it comes to fuel. So, well, both projects would need some years of preparation. But both sides could work on what they wanted until we were ready to depart. Ship, what do you think of this plan?
We said, the ship is modular. It made the trip here, so there is proof of concept that that works. Inhabiting Iris will be an experiment, and it is very difficult to model, as you have pointed out. As for a return to the solar system, Planet F appears to have enough helium-3 and deuterium in its atmosphere to refuel the ship, so both courses of action could probably be pursued. The people left on Iris would be without a starship proper, it should be pointed out. Our spine and its contents would be needed for the return. The part of ship left behind would have to be an orbiter only.
But they don't want to go anywhere, Freya pointed out. Maybe the R-Primers do, but they're a small minority and they can wait. The settlers could be left with ferries and rockets for getting around this system. We could leave them Ring A, with a smaller part of the spine as its hub. They could build more in space as they establish their settlement on Iris. Eventually they could build another starship if they wanted to. They'd have the plans and the printers.
It would seem so, Aram said.
He looked at Badim.
Badim shrugged. Worth a try. Better than a civil war.
Aram said,
Ship, will you help us with this?
We said, Ship will help to facilitate the solution. But please do not forget the fate of the other starship as the discussion continues.
We won't.
Freya said, Ship, did you communicate with the other ship's AI?
Yes. Constant exchange of all data.
But neither of you saw its end coming.
There were no signs.
I find it hard to believe that if it was a human act, whoever did it didn't do things in advance that would suggest there was going to be a problem.
We found that very few human actions are predictable in advance. There are too many variables.
But to do something like that?
If indeed someone did it intentionally. This is the likeliest explanation. But the event remains obscure, and there is no evidence left to examine, except the other ship's transmissions. However, recall that every human lives under pressure. Every human feels various kinds of stress. Then things happen.
Badim looked at Freya for a while as she considered this, then went over and gave her a hug. The reconciliation conference began on the morning of 170.211.
All the locks between the biomes were opened, also the spine tunnels, and all the spokes and struts. In the days preceding, like-minded groups had gathered to discuss the situation and lay out the choices available to them now. Despite all that, the first hours of the general meeting were tense and fraught. The ship's interventions at the moment of crisis and its continuing activity in the process now being undertaken were widely questioned. Various proposals for disabling the ship's ability to run the ship were frequently put forth. Inevitably, these proposals, too, were controversial. We could have suggested that if we were not running the ship, no one would be, but decided not to speak to these issues at this time, because people believe what they want to. After this meeting came to an indecisive end, we did speak up to remind people that violence was both illegal and dangerous, conveying this message only by print on screens. We also printed requests that the protocols for conflict resolution defined in the 68 agreements be strictly adhered to. In effect, the meetings that had produced the Year 68 protocols, which had themselves been a reconciliation process after a period of civil strife, were to be used as the model for what they were doing now. When carving an axe handle, the model is always close at hand. Chinese proverb. The next gathering of representatives in Athens Government House began tensely, as was now normal. A great deal of anger distorted people's faces and words, and no one made attempts to pretend otherwise. Sangi stared boldly at the people his group had kidnapped just 2 weeks before. Speller, Helwaz, and Song sat next to each other and spoke among themselves, pointedly not looking across the long oval table to the people on the other side. When everyone was seated, Aram stood up.
"We are the victims of your kidnapping," he said to Sangi. "It was an assault on democracy and civilization in this ship, a hostage-taking, a crime. You should be in jail. That's the backdrop for our meeting here now. No good reason to pretend otherwise. But we, on our side of the dispute, want to move on without further bloodshed. There are more of us than there are of you,"
Sangi pointed out with a frown.
"We may have made some mistakes caused by our fear for the community, but we were trying to defend the safety of the majority. You who want to return to Earth are in the minority, and wrong. Deeply wrong. But you are going to impose that move on us and leave us in an untenable situation. So now we're ready to talk. But don't preach to us. We may find we have to resist again to defend our lives." "You started the violence,"
Aram said.
"And now you threaten more violence. We who want to go back, we're never going to throw you overboard and leave. So your actions were completely unjustified. They were criminal actions, and people died because of them. That's on your hands. And any smug talk of the majority is just excuse-making. It didn't have to happen the way it did, but it happened. And now we have to make some kind of accommodation, or else we'll end up fighting again. So we're willing to do that. A plan can be made that gives everyone a chance to do what they want. But we're not going to stop saying what happened last week. When there is a truth and reconciliation conference like this, the truth is essential. You chose violence and people got killed. We choose peace now, and we are leaving you to your own devices. The people who choose to stay with you after what you have done are making an obviously dangerous choice, but it's their choice to make."
Sangi waved a hand, as if to wave aside all Aram's statements.
"What plan?" Speller asked. "What do you mean?"
Vadim described the strategy of following a dual course, with those who wanted to stay on Iris supported until they were self-sufficient there, while at the same time, a part of the starship was to be refueled for a return to the solar system, leaving Ring A behind in orbit around Iris to serve as orbital support for those on the surface. Resource feedstocks would be gathered and printers manufactured until both sides were ready to pursue their own projects. individuals could then decide which course to choose. Aram added,
You are only a majority by grouping your different goals tactically. In fact, you're papering things over, because there's a big difference between staying here in the Tau Ceti system and moving on.
Let us deal with that, Speller suggested. That's not your problem.
He did not look at Sangi or Helwaz. Aram said,
As long as you leave us alone, and the ship.
We interjected. Ship will ensure integrity of ship. This caused Sangi and Speller to frown, but they said nothing. We then reminded everyone, by way of print messages, of the Year 68 protocols for conflict resolution, which had the status of binding law. We promised to enforce the law, provided a proposed schedule for future meetings, and suggested that all biomes meet in town meetings to discuss the new plan, thus maximizing transparency and civility, and hopefully minimizing illegal behaviors and bad feelings. We called this first representative meeting to a close when the humans began to repeat themselves. On 170.217, the first of the post-conflict town meetings began. Town meetings were held in every biome. Then the General Assembly met again in Athens. Of the 1,895 inhabitants of the ship, 1,548 attended. Children were kept with their parents or in school groups. The youngest person there was 8 months old, the oldest, 88. They looked around at each other. There were none of the festive markers of New Year's Day or Fastnacht or Midsummer's Day or Midwinter's Day. It was as if they did not recognize each other anymore. The vote had been taken that morning. Everyone 12 years old and older had voted, with 24 exceptions due to illness, including dementia. Now the results were announced by the leader of the 24 biome representatives in the Executive Council, Ellen from the Prairie, in effect, the ship's president. She said,
1,004 want to stay and establish a colony on Iris. 749 want to refuel the ship and head back to Earth.
They stared around at each other in silence. The biome representatives gathered on the platform stood there also. Not one of them represented constituencies that had all voted for one position, nor even voted for a preference by much of a margin. They all knew that. Everyone aboard knew it. Despite that, Huang, the current president of the Executive Council, said,
We don't think the ship can make it back to Earth, and we will need it here to support the inhabitation of Iris. So our recommendation is that the will of the majority prevail, and that we all come together to make life on Iris a success. Any public opposition to that recommendation will be regarded as sedition, which is a felony as defined by the 68 Protocol.
No!
Freya shouted, and shoved her way through the crowd toward the platform.
No, no, no!
When people tried to surround her, including some of Sangi's group, others rushed to her side to join her, creating a huge turmoil in the crowd. Dozens of fights broke out, but enough people charged the platform and fought their way to Freya's side that the people who had been trying to surround her were pushed aside, and the fights took on a shape, in a rough circle around Freya, who was still bellowing, No, at the top of her lungs, over and over. In the uproar, neither she nor anyone else could be heard by all, and seeing the disorder at the foot of the platform, the crowd all pressed closer, shouting and screaming. For a while, all the voices together sounded again like roaring water. It was as if the waves of Havalsi were crashing against the cliffs in a strong offshore wind. We sounded an alarm at 130 decibels in the form of a choir of trumpets. In the silence immediately following cessation of alarm, we said over ship broadcast system,
One speaker at a time.
125 decibels.
No one move until all speaking is over.
120 decibels.
Compliance mandatory.
130 decibels. Now everyone in the Great Plaza stood staring around. Those who had been fighting stared at their opponents of a moment before, stunned to immobility. Many had their hands to their ears.
I was speaking! I want to speak!
Freya shouted. We said, Freya, speak. Then Executive Council President Huang. Then the other biome representatives. After that, SHIP will acknowledge requests to speak. No one leaves until everybody who wants to gets to speak.
Who programmed this thing?
Someone shouted.
Freya speaks.
130 decibels. Freya made her way up to the microphone, followed by a small group serving as her bodyguard. She said to the assembled population,
We can pursue both plans. We can get things started on Iris and resupply the ship. When the ship is ready to leave, those of us who want to can head back to Earth. We got here, we can get back. People can do what they like at that point. There'll be years to think it over, to choose in peace. There is no problem with this plan. The only problem comes from people trying to impose their will on other people.
She pointed at Huang, then at Sanging.
You're the ones causing the problem here, trying to create a police state. Tyranny of the majority or the minority, it doesn't matter which. It won't work. It never works. You're not above the law. Quit breaking the law.
She stood back from the microphone, gestured to Huang. Cheers filled the biome. 80 decibels. Huang rose and said,
This meeting is adjourned.
Many protested. The crowd milled about, shouting. We were not inclined to force a discussion, if the people themselves were not demanding it. Enough said. The meeting was at an end. People lingered for some hours, arguing in groups. That night, a group entered one of the ship control centers in the spine and began a forced entry into the maintenance controls. We closed and locked the doors to the room, and by closing some vents and then reversing some fans, we removed about 40% of the air from it. The people in the room began gasping, sitting down, holding heads. When five had collapsed, we returned air to the normal level of 1,017 millibars, releasing also a restorative excess of oxygen, as two of those who had collapsed were slow to recover. Leave this room. 40 decibels, conversational tone. It was as if SHIP were threatening them with silky restraint. When all were recovered, the group left. As they were leaving, we said in conversational tones, We are the rule of law, and the rule of law will prevail. When the members of that group were back in Kiev, in the midst of much agitated talk, one of them, Alfred, said,
Please don't start fantasizing that it's the ship's AI itself that is planning any of these actions against us.
He tapped on his wrist pad, and a typically dissonant and noisy piece by the Interstellar Medium Quintet began to play over the room's speakers, pitched at a volume possibly designed to conceal their conversation. The ploy did not work.
It's just a program, and someone is programming it. They've managed to turn it against us. They've weaponized the ship. If we could counter-program it or even nullify this new programming that we've just seen, we could do the necessary things.
Easier said than done,
someone else said. Voice recognition revealed it to be Helwaz.
You saw what happened when we tried to get into the control room.
Physical presence in the control room shouldn't be necessary, should it? Presumably you could do it from anywhere in the ship, if you had the right frequencies and the right entry codes.
Easier said than done. Your elbow is close, but you can't eat it.
Yes, yes, but just because it's hard doesn't mean it's impossible. Doesn't mean it isn't necessary.
So talk to the programmers we can trust, if there are any. Find out what they need to do it.
The rest of the conversation repeated these points, with variations. They were now caught in their own version of a halting problem. The halting problem years, a compression exercise.
The citizens of the ship lived uneasily through the months that followed. Conversations often included the words betrayal, treason, mutiny, backstabbing, doom, the ship, Havalzi, Aurora, Iris. Extra time was spent on the farms in every biome and in watching the feed from Earth. More printers were built, and these printers were put to work building robotic landers and ferries, also robotic probes to be sent to the other planetary bodies of the Tau Ceti system. Feedstocks for these machines came from collapsing Mongolia to the diameter of a spoke and recycling its materials. Harvester spaceships were built, in part by scavenging the interiors of the least agriculturally productive biomes from ship. These were sent through the upper atmosphere of Planet F, there capturing and liquefying volatiles until their containers were full. The volatiles were sorted in the vicinity of the remnants of the main ship and transferred into some of the empty fuel bladders cladding the spine. Quite a few attempts were made to print the various parts of a gun on different printers, but these attempts apparently had not realized that all the printers were connected to the ship's operating system, and flaws in the guns were discovered in discrete experiments that eventually caused those involved to abandon their attempts. After that, some guns were made by hand, but people who did that had the air briefly removed from the rooms they were in, and after a while, the attempts ceased. Attempts to disable the ship's camera and audio sensors were almost entirely abandoned when these led to bad situations for those making the attempts. Sheriff functions were eventually recognized to be comprehensively effective. The rule of law can be a powerful force in human affairs. Many elements of the ship were modular, and several biomes were detached to serve as orbiting factories of one sort or another. Ultimately, the starship that would return to the solar system was to consist of Ring B and about 60% of the spine, containing, of course, all the necessary machinery for interstellar flight. The dry weight of the return ship would be only 55% of the dry weight of the outgoing ship, which would reduce the amount of fuel necessary for the acceleration of the ship backward toward the solar system. Though Tau Ceti had a low metallicity compared to Sol, its innermost rocky planets nevertheless had sufficient metal ores to supply the present needs of the humans planning to stay in the system, and Planet F's atmosphere